and we have to articulate ourselves, otherwise we would be cows in the field.
Hello, welcome to Cows in the Field, a movie podcast. I'm Laura.
I'm Justin.
And today we're talking about Terminator 2, one of Justin's most favorite films.
This is one of my favorite movies. When I made a list of my one movie every year, this was my favorite movie of 1991.
Okay.
So it's a very important movie to me. And it's a movie that I've loved ever since I was a child, a small child, when I first saw it. I tried to see it in theaters, but I couldn't for some reason.
It's R-rated R.
Yeah, it's rated R, but I mean, I was with my parents and they were willing to show it to me, but I don't know, for some reason I couldn't see it in theaters. So I did see it, I think, when it came to home video.
But okay. Anyway,
yeah. So, and it was always the one that my dad used whenever he wanted to test out his sound surround sound system.
Yep. Yeah, okay.
This was the one.
My dad did Saving Private Ryan. But perhaps that's later too.
It's later. It's a good one.
What did you do
one.
Between 1991 and
yeah, I know my dad was using this one in 2010 to test the surround sound system. I mean, it's good for surround sound.
If it's not broke, don't fix it.
It's an incredible movie is one of the best action movies. I think it might be the best sequel ever. I mean, it's really an incredible movie.
It is. It's definitely, we're Cows in the Podcast, Cows in the Field, a podcast. This is a sacred cow for Justin, I would say. It's a comfort food for Justin. Sometimes when we have downtime, he just wants to watch, he'll be like, let's just watch 10 minutes of Terminator 2.
Yeah. No, totally.
Like, he's an old taste.
I just throw on, you know, there are a couple scenes that I really like in this movie, in particular, the breakout scene when Sarah Connor breaks out of the prison, but not prison. She's in the mental hospital, and I really like the Cyberdyne set piece. Followed by, I mean, it's basically nonstop action the last whatever 30 minutes of the movie, and for basically once they get to Cyberdyne and the SWAT team shows up or whatever, it's basically nonstop action. That's when you fell asleep. You were just like, I'm tuned out. I get it. They're bad guys. They're going to shoot each other. It's over.
Yeah. So you're going to call me out. I didn't know if you're going to expose me or not. Yeah, I think I've fallen asleep every time at the end of that final sequence. There's a lot of really good action, but by the time we get to the end, I think I'm a little fatigued, and it's just straightforward action. I really like the break-in, though, to Cyberdyne.
The break into Cyberdyne.
Yeah, I love that one. I think I'm maybe one of the movie to end after that.
Wait, what part? With the break-in is just what they like when they hide, when they sort of tie up the guard. Which part of the break-in?
I like the whole thing all the
way
down.
Oh, you mean
to
all the Cyberdyne stuff?
All the Cyberdyne stuff. Cyberdyne, I think it's a great cool. action. I think there's enough like pieces of it that like I'm like stay engaged.
Yeah. And but then once the last they get one in is the like, helicopter and stuff.
Yeah,
then
you're like, yeah.
Yeah, but he's got three arms and it's incredible. I mean, three arms. And you know, and they go from helicopter, SWAT van to then they switch vehicles in the middle of the highway. Switch vehicles, right? Because the helicopter has crashed,
right.
And the SWAT van has crashed. The good guys get in some other truck.
Mm-hmm.
The vehicle's top speed is 60 miles per hour or something like that. And
right.
And T-1000's got it. He's sitting in the liquid nitrogen tanker. I mean, it's just. You couldn't write a better action sequence. It just flows so perfectly. And of course, they end up at a steel mill. I mean, it's just one of the best series of action set pieces that just keeps upping itself, mm-hmm. right? Like you think like the Cyberdyne shootout, you're like, that's pretty dope. And then they're like, man, they're flying a helicopter under bridges and stuff. This is nuts. Then the helicopter crashes and then they get in a truck thing. And then you're like, where are they going to go from here? And then it crashes into the liquid metal place, or not, whatever, the molten lava place, and then you're like, that's it, it's over, they've defeated, nope, he's melting again, it's so good, it's just, and then they got to duke it out, and they're more hand-to-hand. I mean, there's not much more you could ask for in a movie, except this movie is going to still give you more. That's one of the things we're going to talk about today.
Okay. Before we jump into themes, you know, and you've got your notes all laid out, so we got a lot to talk about. But do you want to talk about Terminator 1 and Terminator 2? Why you like Terminator 2 more than Terminator 1?
Sure. I like Terminator a lot. Number one, there's a certain.
Sorry. Yeah, I knocked the mic.
Yeah, we're still learning how to do this. There's a certain like style in T1 that is, it's just, I find it so unsettling. Especially when, you know, they're using a certain film stock that I find just deeply unsettling, partly because I have its weird associations with Terminator 1. But, you know, like maybe 25 minutes into the movie, Arnold Schwarzenegger gets his eyebrows burned off. And then the rest of this movie, it's just creepy. It looks so uncanny.
He's really gross in that
He's
movie.
All waxy and just,
Terminator 2, he's like the same model, but an upgraded version, right? Because he's not he's not degrading at the same rate.
No, he doesn't take as much damage in T2 until basically he's about to go.
But isn't this like Terminator's skin rotting off?
Yeah, it is, because he's been taking damage all throughout. Like, he's been taking hits and stuff, and he had to cut his eyeball out because it got messed up in a car accident.
Okay.
And so then he spends like a chunk of the movie like just degrading.
I see.
And in T2, he doesn't really start taking damage. I mean, he gets shot.
He gets shot a couple times.
He doesn't really take.
Because in T2, he says he could live for like 800 years or something.
Well,
like
I mean, as long as.
So presumably Terminator 1 could have lived that long as well if he hadn't taken so many hits.
I think he's supposed to basically be the same. Terminator. Okay.
Just different orientation.
That's a small issue. Okay, not really sure. But I mean, the T1, though, the thing is, it's just less, you know, it's a horror movie and this is an action movie. And T1 is really one of the, you know, it is a great horror movie. It's to me, it's scarier than movies. Well, I don't know. It depends on how you want to think about it. But it's scarier to me than a movie which is very similar, like Halloween, partly because it's believable that there would be this entity that is unstoppable that's coming to get you, whereas Michael Myers, he's just a crazy guy, you know,
right?
Like, you could shoot him and he'll die. This is something that like can't be shot or reasoned with or anything, and that is quite scary.
I'd never thought about them as different genre movies. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think it is a different genre. I mean, it's also, you know, that's my take on. Do you have a preference on T1, T2?
No, not really.
You don't care one way or the other. You're just even. I feel like T2 is just like leaps and bounds a better movie, and that's insane because T1 is such a good movie. It is an incredible movie. It's an accomplishment to have done what he did, you know, in such a small budget. But it's just that T2 takes the big budget and he just elevates it. And Cameron is this kind of director that somehow manages to make beefy, muscular movies that have, you know, they make it that challenge the audience and make things difficult for the audience and also easy in a way that just holds up. Like like, what I mean by challenging is that, like, you know, he the stress is there, it's palpable, it's you know, this movie holds up today, but it's also easy in that it's a very easy watch. Like, you don't need, there's not like heavy exposition. It's everything just plays out very, very naturally, and there's causality to everything that happens. So you understand sort of why you're doing what you're doing at any given point. And it's ultimately a very simple movie. I mean, it's basically three or four people, and they're running around and chasing each other, and that's kind of it. And it's very straightforward. And I think that's one of Cameron's, you know, real strong suits. Is in, they take a movie like Titanic, where, you know, it's this movie which could be this huge bloated mess, and he could have focused on 1,000 characters, but he really just focuses on like 4 characters, really, you know, and the interactions between them. And it sort of pares everything down and makes it manageable in a way that it otherwise wouldn't be. So he takes, I mean, that's a movie, that's a huge movie, right? That's like a massive scale movie, but it really, it stays tight because it's focused on these few characters. And I think the same for Terminator 2, for this big budget movie. I mean, just compare it to the big budget movie of last year or whatever, Avengers Endgame, which is just like a huge, I mean, they pull it off, but it's a huge mess of a million characters and everyone only has 5 lines.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny. I don't know that anybody's ever called Titanic tight. I think it does get accused of being bloated, but I think it holds your attention for all those reasons that you said, that it has strong storytelling and it's focusing on a few characters. Maybe if the framing device is the issue.
But. I mean, we will eventually do Titanic because I think it is one of your favorite movies. We'll come back and do some more Cameron. But sure. Today we're doing T2, and I wanted to talk a little bit about I think one of the central things in this movie, which is the time travel conceit, because this is a movie where, which on a certain level has an incredibly contrived plot line. I mean, the first one did too, which is that these machines are fighting these humans for sort of dominance over the planet. And instead of just basically, you know, killing the humans, which they're pretty much, you know, they're in a pretty good position to do, as far as I can tell from all the scenes we see of the future, they decided to do this very convoluted thing of inventing a time machine and sending a machine back to kill the leader of the resistance before he is conceived, blah, blah, blah. And of course, that plot sort of is foiled by the humans who send back Kyle Reese to protect John Connor, the leader of the resistance, his mother. So that's the plot of the first Terminator. But so it's helpful to think about what, like, this is a time travel movie that is consistent and coherent, unlike many other time travel movies, which I think struggle to find a kind of coherent picture of the metaphysics of time. And so I think it's useful to sort of look at exactly why this is a coherent time travel story, partly because it might seem at face value like it's not coherent. And so to give you an example, this is the character Kyle Reese, who does not appear in this movie but is in the first movie. Take the story of Kyle Reese. I'm going to tell the story of Kyle Reese, but and it's going to seem like we have a contradiction. It's going to seem like Kyle Reese dies before he's born, which you might think, how could that be? How could somebody die before they're born? And that way to understand at least this puzzle is to distinguish two notions of time. So you have the personal time of Kyle Reese and the objective time. So in the personal time of Kyle Reese, and I looked this up, so this, I guess, is canon. He was born in 2004, and he lives for 25 years, and then he's fighting in the resistance and stuff during this time. And he's chosen by John Connor in 2029 to go back in time to protect Connor's mother. So 2029, he's been alive for 25 years. He's sent back in time to 1984, where he's killed by the first Terminator in the original movie. So he dies before he's born. But of course, that's the way the story is told in objective time. In Kyle Reese's time, he's born, he lives for 25 years, then he goes back in time and he dies. So he doesn't die before he's born. He dies after, in qua personal time. So distinguishing personal time and objective time is important to diffuse at least that apparent contradiction in the time travel story. And the other thing that that might seem at least to be an inconsistency or contradiction in the movie is the existence of closed causal loops in the plot line. So there are at least two. So the first is the existence of John Connor is itself a closed causal loop. So here's John Connor's story told in a basically a loop. So in 2029, Kyle Reese enters the time machine and he returns to 1984, where he meets Sarah Connor, the woman he's been tasked to protect. And they end up having sex. They conceive a child. Reese is then killed by the Terminator. Sarah Connor gives birth to a child. She names John Connor. He grows up to become the leader of the resistance against the machines. He eventually selects Kyle Reese in 2029 to go back in time and protect his mother. And so in 2029, Kyle Reese enters the time machine, etc. So that's the closed causal loop of John Connor's existence. If another way of thinking of it is counterfactually, if Connor hadn't chosen Kyle Reese to enter the time machine, Kyle Reese would not have entered the time machine to go back in time. If Kyle Reese hadn't entered the time machine to go back in time, he wouldn't have had sex with Sarah Connor, thus becoming John Connor's father. And if John Connor had never been conceived, he would never have been around later to send Kyle Reese back in time. So there's a closed causal loop. But there's nothing inconsistent about this. It just means that there's no way to enter into this loop from the outside. It's always there. It's as if for all time there's been this loop in the causal structure of the universe. Now, the second closed causal loop, I think it's interesting to me, actually, that this is a theme we're going to come back to, that there's a parallel between John Connor's existence being a closed causal loop and Skynet, the machine artificial intelligence, also existing in this universe as a closed causal loop. And it's interesting because those are the two sort of poles, the good and the evil, and they both exist in this closed loop status. So here's the story of Skynet's existence. In 1984, the government discovers a damaged but intact robot arm and computer chip. Later then, in 1991, reverse engineering technology from the chip, Cyberdyne systems engineer Miles Dyson invents a revolutionary microprocessor that's used to implement the Skynet artificial intelligence system. Skynet then begins to integrate with the defense systems, eventually going online in 1997 and assuming full control of all defense decisions. At that point, it becomes self-aware, realizing its enemy is the humans, initiates a nuclear holocaust to attempt to wipe out humanity. The survivors then mount a resistance against Skynet. In the ensuing battle, Skynet attempts to eliminate the leader of the resistance, John Connor, by sending a Terminator back in time to kill his mother before he's conceived in 1984. That Terminator is destroyed, leaving a damaged but intact robot arm and computer chip, which is discovered by the government in 1984, and so on. So that's the loop again. Again, there's no way to step outside of the loop and tell the story of how this came to be. It just always loops back around on itself. Again, and also that's not a contradiction. I mean, it's just, it's an interesting feature of the causal structure of this universe. Mm-hmm. And there could be closed causal loops in our universe, for all we know, you know, if there were time travelers and so on.
Just as a sidebar, a lot of that exposition is delivered really naturally, or sort of because it's delivered by the Terminator, or not by Schwarzenegger, who has like a Wikipedia in his head, or he has a lot of detailed files, right? He's got detailed files on everybody.
Yeah.
Which is nice, you know, because it's sometimes hard to, there's voiceover in this movie, mm-hmm. which is sometimes used for plot, but more for her internal dialogue, oftentimes just her musings yep. on various things. But it's helpful that a lot of the times where they're trying to explain this world or fill in some plot, it's done through a really natural back and forth between Arnold Schwarzenegger as Terminator and John Connor as a kid who's just like inquisitive and trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, or Sarah. I mean, because Sarah's yep. asking, she's like, tell me what happens, yep. right? So that she can then, because she's deciding whether she wants to ultimately try to change the fate that right. she's been presaged. So yeah, they're just like trying to figure it out, right? They're just asking the kinds of questions you might ask this thing that's coming mm-hmm. from the future. The very natural questions. So that actually brings us to the other issue in this movie, which is left unresolved at the end of the movie and then is resolved, I think, in a much less enjoyable way in Terminator 3 and 4, et cetera.
I haven't seen any of those.
Yeah, they're terrible. But which is whether you can change the future, right? Mm-hmm. Whether these things, now that the Terminator has come back from the future, right, into this what seems to be the present, whether it's possible from now to do things which will ultimately change the future. And the characters act as if they're going to change things, right? They say, like, maybe we're going to change it. We're going to destroy all the evidence of the first Terminator and everything's going to go away. And then that'll be it. Like, nobody will be able to discover Skynet, and that, you know, so it won't happen anymore. But of course, that to many philosophers actually is thought to be impossible because of course the Terminator is here. So the Terminator is incontrovertible evidence that they didn't do that. Mm-hmm. So here's a picture of time in which that is impossible. So imagine time as a big static block. It's a four-dimensional block. So you can move in the block, you know, sort of up and down. That's, those are the spatial dimensions. And then you can also move towards the right. That would be going into the future. And if you move towards the left, you'd be going into the past. So there'd be a, this kind of block like that. Now, if it, time is a 4D block, you can explain basically everything in this movie, right? It all makes perfect sense. The closed causal loops make perfect sense in a floor block, in a four-dimensional block universe. And everything that has basically happened will always have happened and has always happened.
Okay. What are the other dimensions of the block? So right, left.
Three spatial dimensions. Right. I just described them in two spatial dimensions and
right.
one.
Right, but going up and dimension. Down, what does that represent?
Spatial.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. I was thinking of if you array the block as a two-dimensional square, then up and down are spatial dimensions and left, right are temporal dimensions.
Temporal. Okay.
But really you want to think of it as there's three spatial dimensions and then a fourth temporal dimension, right. which you have to like imagine the block like extending through time. Right. It's hard to get your head around. Yep. But that's the idea.
Okay.
Now, on that picture, there's no changing the future, right? The future just is what it is. They just don't know what it is. They'll find out when they get there, but that's it. It's also a picture in which it's very natural to think there is no privileged present. There's no privilege now. There's just a bunch of times. They happen to be here. Other people are later, and that's it. There's no sort of now and later. There's just things... Well, sorry, there's later, but there is no now and... Or past and future. There's just... things that are happening later than now, than we are, and things that are happening earlier than we are. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And everyone can sort of orient themselves like that. Just like there's no, you might think on the planet, there's no like privileged here. There's just where people happen to be on the planet. So on that picture, there's no changing the future. But there is a picture of time travel where you can change the future, which is actually quite interesting. And but it does... To make sense of it, it is kind of radical. So here's a different way to do it. So you want to just, on that, the original picture I was describing, you really just have one dimension of time. But suppose you actually had two dimensions of time. So you had your four-dimensional block, and then you had another dimension, a fifth dimension of time. So call the dimension of time in the block time.
Okay.
And then call the time that the block time is embedded in, this fifth dimension, meta block time.
Oh, gosh.
Okay, so now imagine the block
I'll try.
As growing. Okay, so the block grows. It's not static, it's dynamic. It grows, and it grows in meta time. Okay, so as meta time goes, the block grows a little bit, right? And the edge of the block on this understanding is now. So now we have a now, and the now is always moving to the future, and as it moves to the future, it grows. Of course, why do you want to think of it as growing? Is you want to think the past is fixed, so you can kind of go back to the past, but you can't go to the future.
The future
doesn't exist right. yet. It's growing with us, right? It's changing with the choices that we make and so on. So time travel on this picture would involve resetting now. It would involve destroying the future. Shrinking the block down back to, say, if you're going from 2029, shrinking it back down to 1984, and then letting the block grow again in meta time. So meta time is always moving forward, but the block time can change because the block time is shrinking and then growing again. So just imagine Kyle Reese goes back in time from 2029. What happens? He shrinks the block down to 84. Now the block starts to grow again. Now Kyle Reese does something different, right? He does different things. Maybe he, you know, defeats the Terminator or whatever. Maybe now John Connor they destroy Cyberdyne and so on. Now, actually, let's do that one. So take the T-800 that John Connor reprograms in 2029 to go back and protect his mother, right? So this is the plot of Terminator 2.
Mm-hmm.
So he reprograms the Terminator in 2029, sends him back. He ends up in 1991 or whatever. Now the block has been reset to 91. Now, if they're successful in 1991, the future will play out very differently, and there won't be an event anymore of John Connor sending the Terminator back into the past, right? It will have been erased. That is coherent as far as I can tell. So it's just a picture where you can't retrace your steps, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas in the other, in the block picture, the static block picture, you can retrace your steps, and that you just inevitably, you always end up retracing your steps. You'll always do your same, exactly. Mm-hmm. But on the growing block, you can't retrace your steps. I mean, right. Or you, it's possible to not be able to retrace your steps, mm-hmm. if you do things right. And so I think that is a coherent picture that, and it's possible that that is one in which that is a picture that can make sense, at least, of what the characters who are desiring to change the future are actually trying to do.
Right.
Now, notice, though, what's interesting about this is that on the growing block time travel picture, when the time traveler goes back in time, he basically commits mass murder because he basically eliminates all these people. They immediately go out of existence, right? They immediately just cease to exist. And now they might re-exist, right? They might come back into existence if he doesn't do enough changes in earlier in time. But if he does certain changes and they propagate and mm-hmm. people don't meet who would otherwise met and so on, then they never have their children, and that those children are basically lost to existence forever.
Right. Well, that's interesting because the whole thing that they're trying to prevent is the Judgment Day, is the apocalypse, the mass death from... What is it? So Skynet launches a missile on Russia, so that Russia will retaliate, and then millions of people die in the U.S. Is that what that's what happens? That's what they're trying to prevent. So the whole thing is about preventing mass death, and in fact, by changing the future, you also are perpetrating mass
potentially murder. Potentially. I mean, here's how it would have to work. It would have to be something like, well, as a result of Dyson not inventing Skynet, mm-hmm. Certain changes happen that propagate, and then certain people don't meet, and then they don't have sex at that time, and they don't procreate in the right way or whatever, and, mm-hmm. and you can imagine the kind of butterfly effect of these changes propagating out and leading to lots of people never coming to be.
Aren't everything that we do in the world perhaps preventing somebody from not coming to be?
Totally. But the interesting thing about this is that the time traveler is, in this case, responsible for eliminating from existence everyone.
People who did in fact come to be.
Who did in fact exist. Right. And then they just don't get to come back, I guess, when the block is regrown.
Yeah.
But
they don't know any different. They've lived their lives in the other,
That's right.
part of the block.
So I think that I can make sense of that, also that interpretation of the movie. And, I don't know if I believe in that notion of time. I don't know what I believe as far as the metaphysics of time, but I do think it's at least an interesting way of understanding, the movie.
Do you remember the exact quote? What does John Connor say about this? Like, it hurts your head to think about? Or when he explains he's telling the Terminator that his mom has told him, that in fact he sent his friend back in time to make himself.
Yeah.
And he says something about
it. I don't remember what he says.
I wish I had it at my fingertips.
It's a real oracle of the Matrix. It's a real noodle baker, right? She bakes your noodle.
Yeah, right.
And that's the same thing. They're talking about foreknowledge and what would have happened had she not said the thing, had warned the guy about mm-hmm. the foreknowledge that she had. These are interesting philosophical puzzles that I think, they basically put a lot of pressure on our ordinary understanding of time and freedom and causality, which is just, that's, what philosophy is all about. Anyway.
When this movie was one of your favorites as a kid, were the philosophical puzzles part of what hooked you in? And were you like a little proto philosopher before you knew it?
I don't think I can take any credit in that regard. No, I think I was
just because it's a great action movie.
Yeah, I think I was just into the action.
Yeah.
I mean, I was like,
did the kid aspect of it appeal to you too as a kid?
I think definitely. Yeah, yeah. I think that's a big part of it is that I mean, it was a genius move to basically set it at he's age 10. I mean, that's a little bit young for watching this movie, but
yeah.
I mean, I would have been.
I think a lot of 10-year-olds saw it anyway.
No, yeah. Totally. And I was about 8, and I think when it came out, and when it was sort of in theaters, or I was seven, I guess. But when I saw it, I was probably 8 or 9.
Cameron's a genius. He's like, we need a kid to say, eat my shorts.
It is genius.
Take my money.
That's part of the reason the movie does so much better than Terminator is that, like, it's a
family movie.
Family movie, weirdly.
Yeah. Which is like a lot of F-bombs and crazy violence. So, like, yeah.
Totally.
But less killing.
That's right. Yes. Yes. That's actually an important theme. I mean, we should come to some of the themes of the movie, but this idea that about this sort of duality between creation and destruction, mm-hmm. and John Connor being this sort of crass but ultimately Christ-like redeemer figure, right? For his mother, right? His mother who has basically lost all hope, and she's just going to go kill an innocent man to save, right, what she thinks of as saving the future. Mm-hmm. And she can't do it ultimately, but Connor goes to sort of redeem her, to try to prevent her from doing this. He ultimately, I mean, and that is, I think, also speaks to the broader theme of the humanity. What the humans have that the machines don't have is this sense of sympathy and empathy and emotion, these emotional connections, right, that are played in the movie as an advantage, right? And the machines are just these calculating devices, mm-hmm. and they can't understand emotion.
And Sarah Connor, because of her trauma, has become like her own, she's become a Terminator herself.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah, I like that. She's like stripped away all humanity from herself because she's so singularly focused on defending her son and preventing this future, mm-hmm. that
it's
she
for
lost...
like a humanitarian larger cause.
Yeah.
But her actions in the movie are, you know, a lot of cold-blooded killing.
Yeah. Yeah, she's ruthless.
Yes.
And she has a real hard time connecting with John.
Yeah.
There are a lot of scenes where they...
She makes him cry.
Right. She's like really harsh towards him, and it isn't until he comes to sort of rescue her in a way from herself, right? Mm-hmm. From killing Dyson and his family, that she sort of realizes that he has something to teach her.
Yeah. Because she's been wanting to see him for 6 months. And she finally sees him. He breaks her out of the mental hospital. And the first thing she does is just like, you shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. She's like, she agrees with the Terminator, right? It was a bad calculation,
yeah.
right? The Terminator is like, that's a bad move. You don't want to put yourself at risk. And he's just like, fuck you. Like, I'm going to go for it, right? I'm going to just, it's like, I've got to help my mom, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, even though it is the wrong calculated risk to take.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that is an important piece of the duality here, which is like what separates the humans from the machines, and whether we can retain any sense of our humanity in the face of this mounting existential threat to humanity. And it could be that what John, like, we don't really know why John Connor ends up becoming the leader of the resistance, but maybe it is not because he's some amazing tactical warlord like his mother, but maybe it is just because he can inspire humanity, right? Because mm-hmm. he can be this figure who knows how to turn the other cheek in the face of, you know, true horror or whatever and violence. And that's what people need at that moment, you know. I mean, I think another aspect of that is Sarah Connor discusses, well, it's part of her inner monologue that, you know, we learn that she's had many potential father figures come in throughout John Connor's 10 years, yeah. and come in and out of their lives. And they've all been basically never measured up. And presumably that's because Sarah Connor is a maniac who... Right, who's like so singularly devoted to the cause that even the most hardcore gun runner, you know, revolutionary can't keep up with her.
Mm-hmm.
But the only thing that can is the Terminator, right? And she talks very approvingly of him as the ultimate sort of father figure for John Connor.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to what you were saying earlier about this being, so you said it was a family film, but and I took, there's two interpretations that I didn't know which you meant. One is that it's a movie the family goes to see together, mm-hmm. right? It's another is that it's a movie about a family. It's about an adoptive family that's coming together to try to like orient themselves in this chaotic world.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite voiceovers when she's looking at them, high-fiving and thinking about the Terminator as a father figure. The best father figure, because he will never leave.
Yes, exactly. But see, that's the way she sees it. But of course, the Terminator has to learn, and John has to learn that that can't be, right? Like, right. He's a machine.
He does have
they're
to
humans.
Leave.
They're not, they can't coexist, right? They're not supposed to, he's just there to serve a function. He's like a calculator, right? He serves his function and then he has to go because he can't, there can't be any evidence of his existence. But he also explains to John, he doesn't say it that way. He says, I know now why you cry, but I can never do that or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. He's like, I just can't feel it. I can't feel these emotions. Like, I can sort of understand them from some calculation perspective, but, and I think I think in a way the movie then puts to us, I think, a question, which is, you know, a deep question that we all have to sort of think about on our own terms, but which is just, you know, what is it that we value in life, right? And like Sarah Connor, many of us value things like efficiency and, you know, unerringness and, you know, clockwork and these things that a machine can provide. And indeed, machines have made our lives better in innumerable ways because they don't make mistakes the way humans do. But there is something missing, right? And it's not purely an emotional thing. There's something about, like, the spark of creative genius or some artistic inspiration or something. And the way I was thinking of it was, you know, now, for a while now, chess algorithms have been able to basically destroy any human player, right? There's no human who can beat the chess, even, like, relatively weak chess algorithms now. But of course, nobody wants to watch. I mean, some people sometimes watch chess algorithms play each other, but it's like we like watching aliens play chess, and we still want to watch two humans play chess in a tournament. And why? Like, what is that? Like, why do we value that when we know you could just have the two chess? We know the chess algorithms are better.
Yeah.
So why don't we just watch them play?
You can see better chess.
But for some reason, we still, you know, value that. And I think that's something like that is going on in this movie, right? Mm-hmm. Like something like, yeah, the Terminator is the best father figure he could ever have. And yet, he's no father figure at all, right? No. He's not what John needs. John needs a human.
Right. She's life. Defining a father figure in non-human terms, like it's just stability, constancy, none of the emotional support that like Sarah's not giving him either at this point. You know, she's really just trying to like prepare him for a revolution, and in doing so kind of messing him up a little bit.
Yeah,
he's turning out okay, but you know, it's messing with his head.
I mean, I think that is another theme of the movie, which is the parent-child relationship. Yep. And the relationship, obviously, between the two of them. And that relationship is, of course, inverted in the John Connor-Kyle Reese relationship, because Connor is, of course, much older than Reese which is, again, sounds weird, but it is true. He is older than Reese.
And he's his son.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so he is almost a father figure to Reese, right? And so you get this sort of interesting, like, cyclical mm-hmm. parental relationship. But you get that in this movie, too, in that Sarah, it's clear from what's happened off screen that Sarah Connor, you know, was this probably very taskmaster mother to John. And he rebelled against it, especially once she was institutionalized. But then when the Terminator comes around, he realizes she's right. And when they sort of meet for the first time, they have this reconciliation, but it's not a kind of friendly, loving reconciliation. It's actually quite harsh, and she reproaches him for what he did. And then it isn't until he is able to show her some humanity that she was missing, that like, so it comes full circle, and that he ends up playing the parental relationship to her in a way, mm-hmm. by teaching her something about the humanity that she's lost.
Yeah. And in a less profound way too, he's also a bit of a father figure to Terminator, and just that he's teaching him as well.
Mm-hmm.
Terminator is childlike.
Yeah, well, he's in command of him because, mm-hmm. of course, he was the one who reprogrammed the Terminator, right. later on. So right. he programmed.
But he's teaching
it
him to be more human. He's teaching yeah. him slang. He's teaching him, yeah. you know, to think about looking for keys in the visor instead of having to hotwire the car.
Right.
he's it's like training a little puppy.
Yeah, I suppose. But yeah, that's
the
right.
The Sarah Connor stuff, I mean, maybe it is just because now I have mom vision when I'm watching these things, and particularly with little boys. Anytime there's little boys, I get really emotional. But the scene where they're in Mexico before, so, they just got back together again. She just got reunited, and she seemed singular while in the mental hospital and getting to see her son. She sort of pretends that she doesn't know, that she no longer believes in the Terminator and Judgment Day and all this stuff, in an effort to try and see her son and get visiting hours, and it doesn't work out for her. But anyway, so she's so focused on seeing John, and as soon as she sees John, it's not really like what you might expect a mom just respond with. She's rebuffing him. They go and sort of just get themselves cleaned up, clean up their wounds, and then immediately go to Mexico. And as soon as she feels like, oh, he's fine, he's got the Terminator, look, they're high-fiving, everything's great, I'm gonna go do my suicide mission now. And she just drives off, and John sees her drive off, and he like runs after the car screaming at her. He just got his mom back, and and he no longer thinks she's a crazy person. It's so terrible. She's like, it made me sad. she's so focused on her mission, and she's just leaving her son behind. It's for him, but it doesn't feel like it. He can't understand it on that right. level. There's no way.
Right. Yeah. She's like
he
the parent.
He just wants his mom.
Right. She's like the parent who's working late at night because she wants to put food on the table. Yeah. Right. He's like, I can't yeah. explain this to you, but
yeah.
I gotta go and it's kill this guy
yeah.
to prevent the future.
Right.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Yeah. I didn't see it that way, but you're totally right that she sees the Terminator. She's just like, yeah, he's got it. He's got this better than I could. So I'm going to go end it. Yeah, that's really interesting. I think that's absolutely right. And it isn't until, ultimately it's them two at the end of the movie, right? And mm-hmm. it's because John goes back for her mm-hmm. and sort of redeems her in a way.
But like, what was her plan? I mean, maybe she thought she could kill Miles successfully and not die and then get back to him, maybe. but maybe she wasn't gonna make it,
yeah.
and then but she seemed like she's like, well, we've got Enrique,
yeah,
and they've got Terminator, he's good in Mexico, yeah. There's
no, you're absolutely right. I mean, if I think she hadn't had full trust in Terminator, she wouldn't be going back. She wouldn't have done it, right? She's mm-hmm. she's skeptical of the Terminator until she realizes that he's 100% faithful.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's just like, okay, fine. Like, I don't need to be here by John's side. Even though you're right, that the whole first third of the movie, she's fighting to get by John's side.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I think that's exactly right. You know, one of the other themes, speaking of her being institutionalized, is this, this theme that I don't think is, you know, you don't read too much into this, but this theme of the society or the social group versus the individual.
Mm.
And in particular, that's most clear, I think, in the institutionalization scenes where we know and she knows that she's in the right. And yet the system is sort of, you know, locked her down, got her caged up. And, and it's the same with Cyberdyne. Like it's this big system and all these like, you know, politicians and computer programmers and stuff, and it's the one brave individual or couple in this case that are like trying to fight against that to like stop them from doing all this evil that they're about to do unwittingly, but it's a conservative theme, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's an ultimately very conservative theme that there be these, you know, there are these like strong-willed individuals who are gonna buck the the rising tide of society or whatever can save us from ourselves. I think that that is, I mean, it's very, at least a classic American theme. And this is a movie that I think would not have, say, been made in China, for instance.
No. Yeah.
And, I think it's just very, it's very clearly the, you know, the individualistic component is very strong, I think. You know, you see that in like the frustration of her when she's institutionalized, she's right. caged up and
right and we don't see Skynet, we don't really know, like, but there's also sort of an aspect of the of your individual intellectual property or individual discovery or individual creation getting larger and larger than yourself, because I think one of the surprises of the movie is that the character Miles Dyson is a really great, a really sweet guy, and is really horrified to find out what the ripple effects of his discovery will be, and is immediately on board. You know, Sarah's going to go and murder him, and turns out like because I think she thinks he's evil, or maybe she doesn't. Maybe she just thinks it doesn't matter if he's evil or not. The point is he invented something that then will lead to mass murder. So it doesn't really matter what his intentions were. But I think it is sort of a surprise. You might think he's like a mustache twirling evil scientist, but he's a nice guy who loves science, and whatever he discovers, whatever he gleans from the chip in the arm that has been left behind, turns into something much larger and more horrifying and evil than he could ever have known. And perhaps what propels it along are like greedy corporate intentions or the government or, you know, all the institutions that you mentioned
earlier. Yeah. I mean, I like what you're saying, which is that I think the best interpretation of what goes on after the movie ends is that, all that stuff that's filled, that we don't have anything that's just filled in by the Terminator's memory banks, is that it's a bunch of people like Dyson. It's a bunch of people with really good intentions. They're just like, isn't this great? Like the stealth bombers fly with a perfect record and nobody crashes anymore. And nobody makes mistakes when they're calculating game theoretic things about nuclear bombs being sent and so on. It's all done by computer now. It's great. It's perfect, right? There's no room for emotional stuff to get in there and mess it up. All those good intentions aside, it ends up backfiring, right? And so I think that is the best, you know, most interesting, at least, filling in of that story. So I like that what you were suggesting about Dyson. I think we can just extrapolate from that. You know, another aspect of this movie that I think is, so it's a sequel, obviously, and it's a movie that I think is reflecting both on sequels as reproductions or copies of some original and sort of grappling with that very, the sort of the challenge of doing that. It's a movie where you have a copy of the thing that was sent back to kill Sarah and originally, now being sent back to protect her. So there's an inversion of the copy. And then you also have the thing being sent back to kill John Connor now, the T-1000, which we haven't talked about at all, actually, is itself a thing which just copies itself on. It just copies other things. So it doesn't copy itself. It just copies anything it touches. And so...
so long as it's not a complex machine.
No complex machines. But yeah, it can mimic.
As long as it's sort of a solid blob shape, he can blob out in the same shape.
Right. So I just think it's interesting that, you know, Cameron, he has this, he's working with a sequel, and I think this was a sequel nobody wanted. Everyone loved the Terminator, and they're like, great, Arnold's dead. Why would he come back? Mm-hmm. And everyone's like, what is the point of all this? You know, and Cameron is wondering himself too, like, why would I make a sequel, right? And, you know, he's grappling with the challenge there. And so why not make it a copy of the original, basically, and then a thing which can copy things? I think it's an interesting, I mean, I just think it's kind of cool and cute that that's the way he went. And, you know, similarly, the humans create these machines almost like gods, God creates man in his image kind of thing. They humans create these machines like as sort of like replications or reproductions of themselves to carry out the plans and intentions that they have. And of course those things rebel. But in a way the machines are reproductions of the human original, and they are like, they're sort of fighting for their own stake, in the world. And I think that is in a way like T2 is fighting for its stake against T1, right? It's fighting to like exist alongside this movie that was just such an iconic and important action movie of the 80s. And you know, I do think T2 succeeds, but I think it's interesting that I think any sequel is playing out this meta narrative issue of like, first of all, justify my existence, right? Beyond just the cash grab.
Mm-hmm.
And like, why is there a sequel? And that's everyone who writes a sequel struggles with that. And, you know, and then there's a little bit of a fight with the original, right? Like I have to one up it in certain ways, mm-hmm. and so on. So I thought that was interesting. Yeah, you said you had a favorite part.
Oh, my stupid favorite part. My new favorite part upon this viewing is the sound that the grenade launcher makes when he puts a new, what is it, shell in.
Yo, how does it go?
It goes dunk.
So that's your favorite part. Yeah, huh? He does it a lot. So you've got a number of options.
Yeah, I was just repeating it every time. I was just under my breath going dunk.
Yeah, and then once you stopped doing the dunks, I looked at, oh, she's asleep. That's why it stopped.
No, it's because he didn't have that weapon anymore. I don't know, that got discarded at some point. He wasn't dunking in the last scene, which maybe if he was, I wouldn't have.
I think you might have been able to stay engaged in the final battle.
No. I mean, that was just something I noticed. I was just enjoying that in this recent viewing. Oh, I also wanted to mention, you pointed this out. So speaking of reproductions, you pointed this out last night when in the scene where Sarah, this is also doing a bit of exposition, I think. There's a scene in which Sarah is talking to the therapist in the mental institute, and she's watching a video of herself talk about her dream.
Yeah.
Where she sees the sort of nuclear holocaust. And then she ends up attacking the therapist, and you see that through another, there's the TV screen in the background of Sarah. You see Sarah then talking to the therapist, and then there's like a, and then there's the glass pane, and we're looking through the glass pane. And I think at some point,
and you eventually are looking at a screen that's being filmed of the glass, through
right.
the glass
You're looking,
pane.
Cause they're filming this interaction, and there's also a camera. There's also like the TV in the background. Yeah. And I think at one point the therapist, before he gets attacked, breaks the third wall. Sort of, because he's talking to the camera that's filming that session and says like model citizen under
it's
his
a good
breath,
joke,
right?
Yeah.
But it's sort of a break of the fourth wall.
Well, I mean,
a little bit.
He's looking at the camera that is.
He's breaking the fourth wall within the
within
world.
Within the world, yeah.
Right. So not quite talking to us as the audience, but he sort of is.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's, you know, if Cameron is playing with the theme of reproductions, we've got. And a couple of layers
and
there.
Not only that, the images taken from the first movie come back in this movie, right? And there are these parallels that play out of the Terminator gets thrown through glass and the photos are taken. That's a direct shout back to the original movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then similarly, of course, the I'll Be Back. And of course, it's exactly, he does exactly the same thing where he drives the truck right in the front door and just smashes through everything, smashes through the desk and everything. Those things are, they're almost just like tidbits for the audience to like enjoy. But there, I think in this case, they are these interesting like reflections of reflections. And, you know, the Terminator has this, him being an exact duplicate of the original one. There's a lot to work with, mm-hmm. As far as the sort of reflecting on itself motif. So I like that. Yeah, I thought that was a good move, and what elevates. One of the many things that I think elevates this movie probably, I think, into best sequel ever. I mean, a lot of the other sequels that could fit the bill, just a small digression here on sequels, would be Aliens, which is also James Cameron. Mm-hmm. Some people think that's even better than Alien. I don't think either of us are in that category.
No.
But I mean,
although Aliens, I've only seen it the once.
Aliens is really good. I mean, it is really good. And there's some sequences in it that are just like unnervingly good.
Yeah.
In particular, like, remember the part when Newt is with the, just in the water, and the alien rises up behind her.
Yeah.
That's like one of the most, and it's slow-mo. It's a great sequence.
Super scary.
And then the other one is Godfather 2. That's one that a lot of people think is better than the original. And, you know, Godfather 2 is very good, and it might be better than the original, but I still think this is the best sequel. I don't know. I find it hard to beat in my mind, partly just because Godfather 1's already very good, so the fact Godfather 2's a little bit better, it's like, great, it is a little bit better, but I feel like this one, Terminator,
it's a larger step up.
I think it's a bigger step, that's right, yeah, so I think for me,
it looks points. Really, really good.
Yeah, it holds up, the special effects hold up.
Yeah, they do. I don't, so I think, when you ask me if I have thoughts about Terminator 1, Terminator versus Terminator 2, I think I've only seen Terminator once.
I can't be right. We must have seen it more than once.
I don't think so. I think when we watch a Terminator movie, it's always T2. I think we just skip Terminator entirely. I think we've watched Terminator together once. And I certainly had never seen these movies until I met you. This was not on Laura's radar.
Yeah.
At all. So, but I do remember it looking like a little clunkier. Like, you know, the head model when he's pulling out his eye or whatever. Some of it looks a little... little more low tech.
I like that low tech vibe though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really it's unnerving. I like the uncanniness of the weird model and just how waxy and plasticky it looks. It's just creepy.
It is creepy. It doesn't take you out at all?
No.
Okay.
For me, these movies are basically like religious texts. So I can't find fault in them.
Okay, well,
it's like against the creed, okay. Credo.
Well, I'm so sorry.
These movies.
But okay, that aside, you like the look of
I think
of
T2 Terminator, still looks,
but T2 looks better. Looks
better. I mean, he it's everything. More seamless. He has way more money that he's working with.
Yeah, the metal effects are amazing.
Yeah, it's really good. But I mean, one of the things that I think people, you know, they applaud in this movie, of course, is the liquid night, whatever it's called, liquid metal effects are great, but and those were revolutionary, but I think that what Cameron does so well is he uses them so sparingly. He doesn't do very much CGI really there, and instead most of the effects are done practically, and I think that just make it just holds up so much better. And then, of course, he combines the two in really interesting ways. And I think that is what keeps this movie looking so good even today. It's like today this movie would be like 80% CGI shots. And like they would like, I mean, we already know what this movie's going to look like today. It's the latest Terminator movie, right? Which, the Dark Fate or whatever. And... you know,
we'll see eventually, but
it looked by the trailers, right, it just looks like a giant CGI fest, and it just nothing about that movie looks like it's gonna hold up in 5 or 10 years, let alone 30 years.
And we watched Terminator 2, there's stuff where, you know, It's still impressive. It's always impressive to fly a helicopter in a tunnel or under an underpass. Was it under an underpass?
Under the bridge.
Yeah.
Under the overpass. Yeah. So it's, I mean, but apparently that was an incredible, that was like almost like so dangerous that they shouldn't have done it, maybe, like, ethically.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, that is the way I think Cameron approaches filmmaking, is he's like, look, you know, we got some film and we got a camera and we might as well go crazy and do it well. And cause once it's captured on film, it's captured forever, you know? So we might as well go for it. Anyway, but, so I love this movie. Do you have some? Do you have any other thoughts? I do have one more theme, which is a religious theme, mm-hmm. but I don't have that much to say. I mean, I do think it's very the John Connor as Jesus Christ, JC. It's very clearly a religious. He's a sort of redemption figure, this Christ figure. I mean, the idea though that he is immaculately conceived as the closed causal loop, I think is quite smart. That's an interesting thing to do. Then you also have his duel with Skynet, maybe being the devil, and they have a similar immaculate conception. You have Sarah Connor kind of blending the Virgin Mary and the Cassandra figure. Mm. And you know, two thematic women, I suppose, from literature really, but anyway, you know, and, you can think of the nuclear holocaust as a second coming, right? You have like a rapture that happens and then the survivors are the ones left behind to fight.
Right.
And Connor is really like the second coming of Jesus who like leads to salvation. So there's this huge like Christian theme thing going on throughout this entire movie. And, you know, I think it's good. I think it elevates it. It's what it's doing is it's tapping into these Jungian archetypes that are deeply entwined in our like psyche, because they're like part of our, you know, part of our like shared understanding of literary tropes or whatever, mm-hmm. that like keep getting repeated again and again in literature and art and that sort of thing. And so I think by tapping into that, it makes this movie more timeless, more primal, more, even if we're not picking up on that stuff, it's sort of, we recognize these tropes somehow subconsciously and it just resonates with us even mm-hmm. more deeply. So I think it's an absolutely amazing movie. And the fact that, again, it packages this all in this blockbuster action movie that is immediately accessible to literally anyone. You don't even have to speak English, basically. You just sit down and you'll understand what's going on in this movie. It doesn't matter. Like, you get what's happening. You'll know, even if you don't know time travel shit, it's just like, this guy wants to kill this guy and they're running and it's like, you're in. It grips you. I just think it is, I mean, I think that is one of my favorite genre things, which is genre, like sub genres, which is action, or sorry, which is like art house movie disguised as an action film.
Okay.
Right? That's like one of my favorite.
I don't know that you've ever said that's one of your favorite.
Yeah.
We have Justin and I have a running list of Justin's favorite types of movies. We really ought to write this down at one point because
it's always changing. It's always, the genres are flexible.
That's fine. I don't mean that by writing it down, we have to calcify it, but I do just want to try and keep track of the various favorite types of movies that Justin has.
Yeah,
there are a lot. You're gonna hear them, I suppose.
But you know, the other big one for art house disguised as genre, disguised as action, is Inception. Very much so. I would even say Sicario is in that mix. Mm-hmm. Art house disguised as action, and I have to think a little bit more about it. But again, I just made this up right now, so sure. It's hard to know. I can't think about other films that fit that bill, but this one in a way is like, you know, really the, you know, if someone wanted the like exemplary art house disguised as action movie, it would be T2.
Yep.
Because I think it's a lot going on and it's just a fun movie, so you don't need to think about any of this other crap. Just enjoy it.
Yep.
Anyway, do you have any other thoughts about Terminator 2?
No, it's a lot of fun. I like it. I'm sorry that I keep falling asleep at the end, but I like 4/5 of this movie.
Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you.
To the cows in the field, and we will try to keep recording.
If I abandoned this project, I would be a man without dreams. It's not only my dreams. My belief is that all these dreams are yours as well. And the only distinction between me and you is that I can articulate them.